Our 1916 was made with the support of Cork County Council.
Is Michel Limoleche, and I would like to welcome you to Our 1916, a collection of stories, memories and poems from around the time of 1916 here in East Cork and West Waterford. In what was a turbulent and troubled time locally, nationally and indeed internationally, we hope to explore what life was like in this part of the world around that time, and by speaking to a number of historians along with locals whose families were caught up in the troubles, we hope to capture the mood of the time in this programme. I first spoke to historian Kieran McGregor, and he was able to tell me what day-to-day life in Youghal was like around that time.
The 1911 census gives us an incredible picture of the town. Not only the address, but who's actually there. What it tells us, what kind of a house it was, what kind of a roof the house had, how many windows, outhouses. It tells us about the occupations of the people. It tells me how long the family were married, how many children were born, how many actually survived, because there were a lot of infant mortality issues in those days. So you have a huge amount of information, whether they spoke Irish and English or just Irish or just English. Outdoor toilets would have been a standard, and people in living memory will remember Cork Hill, where there would have been things like sewage flowing down Cork Hill at times. It was quite normal not to have... In fact, it was the norm not to have an indoor toilet at the time. But the point I suppose I'm making about the 1911 census is that we have an amazing picture of the housing of the time. It's not just a list of names. There's more than that. There are even if people have serious illnesses. You have a lovely picture of the conditions people had. But we also then from that get the occupations, and some of the occupations are quite different. Some of them no longer exist. There was a family called the Sullivans. They were making ropes. Ones like crochet, dressmaking, lace making. But if you were to go along the main street of Youghal, there were four gunsmiths. Again, you won't see the gunsmiths too easily on the thing today. There were several bakers. There were coachmakers for making harness making. There were coopers making the barrels. There was jarvies, tinsmiths. There were, in the sense you see people were stokers. A jarvie would be in Killarney. Jarvies, the riders, the taxi drivers today.
Taxis in those days. What years are we talking
1916.
About?
1916. Around that time. The taxi of the time would have been a horse-drawn taxi. Right. So it's probably one of the most... interesting aspects of social life in Youghal would have been the fact that the barracks was in operation, and you had 164 men listed in the army barracks, of enlisted men now. And the thing about it is, enlisted men in the army were single. Only 5% would be allowed to ever get married, because there weren't married quarters, and therefore most young soldiers were single. And they're coming into town with money in their pockets and three things in their mind. Drink, major one, gambling, number two, and women, number three. But all those men, they're interested in all sorts of things.
Human nature hasn't changed much.
Well, but young men haven't changed very much. But you have these men coming in, but it's providing an incredible social dynamic to the town. And in addition to that, then those army men and the army officers are organising activities in the town. So there are regattas, there are horse racing out on the Strand.
Kieran also spoke about some of the connections Youghal had with 1916.
The gunboat, the Helga, is another one. That was used in Dublin in 1916, but was given as a present by the English government to the Irish Free State. So when the Civil War broke out, Michael Collins used it to go around Ireland, and he used it to take over Youghal. Now we have the Horgans to thank. The IRA blew up most of the quays in Youghal to prevent anything coming in. So the only place the Helga could actually land was in the actual quay near the tourist office. And they had a winch, so they could winch over their guns and the armoured car that they had. So they came into Youghal, did all sorts of camouflage over the boat to cover it. But they came in early in the morning, took over the barracks, and took over the town, and the first thing they do is they climb the clock gate, put up the flag to show they've taken over the town, and they remain in the town as the force of the town for, you know, during the Civil War. But it's a time of amazing tension. But again, you have that connection between 1916 and the Helga. And so we had a series of talks recently that were called Degrees of Separation, saying not exactly 1916, but there's a 1916 connection with y'all when you look at it.
CRY's own Siobhan Fogarty caught up with Willie McCarthy from the Inchkille Historical Society, and they spoke about members of the Foley family from Killa, and in particular those members of the family who were involved in the Rising, including three sisters.
Bridget and Cott Foley were very prominent figures in the 1916 Rising, and a sister, another sister, Nora as well. So in your research, Willie, what kind of stood out most to you about these sisters from Killa?
Well, I suppose they were, for their time, like they were very forward-thinking women, and they were brave, I suppose, really, when you think of it, that they were actually in the heart of the fighting in O'Connell Street, and they put their own lives in danger. They actually ran over and back to the different buildings delivering messages during the fighting.
They came under very heavy fire. Bridget says it in her military statement. She would have delivered dispatches from the GPO over to other barricades and points across Dublin City during the fighting. And she said that in the notes, gunfire would have been very heavy.
Oh yeah, that would be correct. Like, I think that they were actually in the Hibernian building in O'Connell Street as well, and that was eventually bombarded from the river, and it caught fire, and they had to actually retreat back to the GPO at that stage. I suppose by the Friday of the Rising, it was decided that members of the Cumann na mBan, that the women would actually be sent home for their own safety, but their brother Michal at that stage was still fighting in King Street, so they decided instead of going home that they would actually make their way, the three sisters, to King Street to check out on their brother. And they would have actually, it wouldn't be, I suppose, a great distance from the GPO to King Street, but still it would have been fairly difficult enough to get through to it. And they did actually get to King Street and meet their brother.
Could you tell us a little bit about their schooling and their life growing up before they left for Dublin?
They were born in Knockmanlay. The house is still there. It's owned by Mrs. Kirby now. It's just by the little humpback bridge at Knockmanlay. The first house would be Long's, which is the thatched cottage. And the next house is Foley's. I think there was 12 in the family altogether. There was 11 recorded, I think, in the 1901 census. So there was 12 in family. And in 1889, they were actually evicted, like everyone else on the Ponsonby estate. There was over 240 families evicted from the estate. And Michal actually mentions that in his biography in 1954, that the fact that they were actually thrown out on the road, and there's actually a newspaper record of the eviction, of those few evictions in Knockmanlay, and it is stated in the paper that Richard Foley, he has 12 dependents, and basically they were thrown out and went to live in a little hut in Ballinvarig along with all the other families. And they actually spent 3 years living in those conditions in Ballinvarig.
During the fighting itself, the sisters, that the Foley sisters, they came under a lot of danger, and they worked in nurses' stations as well. Bridget noted that she worked in a nurses' station with her sister during the fighting. And afterwards, they were arrested. Bridget was arrested and spent some time in Kilmainham. And then she was moved to Mountjoy and then interned in a prison in Essex.
Yeah, that is correct. I suppose after they were sent home on the Friday of the Rising, on the following, I think it was on the following Monday, Bridget was actually arrested at her home, and she spent 11 horrendous days in Kilmainham jail. And at one stage she was actually left on her own in the cell, I think, and a priest that had gone in to see her felt for her safety, and he actually stayed the night with her, because I believe the soldiers that were guarding the prisoners were actually drunk. So after that then she spent 6 weeks in Mountjoy, and after that then she was transported to England, like many more, and she wasn't actually released until the August of 1916. After 1916, they were still quite active, and even Sean O'Folloo returned to Dublin, and he was involved as well in the fight for freedom. Caught, I believe, mentions in her statement about at that stage, after getting married, she actually had a car, and she used to drive the car in Dublin, but she would give a loan of the car to the, I think they were the IRA at that stage, if they wanted to use it for anything. And she would actually leave the key in the car for them to just collect. And then I suppose she was covered. She could pretend that somebody just had taken it. I don't believe you'd leave your key in the car anywhere now in Dublin, or let alone outside your own door. Her husband was actually arrested as well. And he was jailed for a time in the Dublin Castle. And she became acquainted with different people who had worked in the castle. And I believe actually that she made contact with Ned Bry. He actually worked in the castle, and he became a spy for Michael Collins.
That was in the film as well.
But Michael Collins actually used to spend time with Bridget, and her brother Michal's house was used as a safe house for Michael Collins during the Troubles as well.
They're formidable. Do you know? I don't think you could say no if you were asked to do something by one of these women at the time. Do you know? Bridget herself describes herself as being roped in with all the in the beginning to help and to volunteer in the marches and parades and nurse duties. But for a woman that was roped in, she really was a prominent figure in the whole thing, wasn't she?
Yes, I suppose she certainly was. You know, when you think of, like, her house would have been raided on numerous occasions by the Black and Tans, and on one of those raids, they had gone through the house, and she noticed that they had thrown burned out cigarettes on the floor, and she called back the commander, and she gave out hell to him, and he made them clean it up. It was mentioned to her at one stage, I don't know, was it during one of those raids or when she was being arrested, that, you know, we could actually kill you, like, for this, and I think her comment was that it's better to die for Ireland, you know, that it would be an honour for her to die for Ireland, like.
It's a very detailed story and a very interesting story, and, like, they're from Killa, and you just, I never knew about them until the commemoration we had there back in March.
One of the great things that arose from this year's celebrations of the Easter Rebellion of 1916 was how much the role of women in that rising has been brought to the fore. Because hitherto, the crucial roles they played had been downplayed very much. Women writers had helped keep the Fenian flame alive in the decades before 1916. Parnell's sisters, Anna and Fanny, especially the latter, were much more extreme in opposition to English rule than Charles Stuart himself was. And the sisters ran the Land League at one point while Parnell and Davitt were in jail. Fanny wrote poems of revolution. And one of the most fascinating of all those writers about 1916 and before is Alice Milligan. Alice was born in Oma, County Tyrone in 1865 to a family of Unionist landowners and Methodists. She went for education to the Methodist College in Belfast and the King's College London. Later, she joined the Gaelic League, and she became very friendly with the likes of O'Donovan Rossa, John O'Leary, Roger Casement, etc. And she wrote many patriotic poems. Now, one of her best-known poems is "When I Was a Little Girl." And of course, when Ellis was growing up, the Fenians would have been presented as a threat. And in this poem, two of her sisters would hide under the bedclothes when they heard about the Fenians. But one little girl wasn't dismayed. And here's what she wrote. "When I was a little girl in a garden playing, a thing was often said to chide us delaying. Come in, for it's growing late, and the grass will wet ye. Come in, or when it's dark, the Fenians will get ye." Four little pairs of hands in the cots where she led those, over their frightened heads pulled up the bedclothes. But one little rebel there, watching all with laughter, thought, "When the Fenians come, I'll rise and go after." Wished she had been a boy and a good deal older, able to walk for miles with a gun on her shoulder.
That was Dungarvan's Jim Ryan with a beautiful rendition of Alice Milligan's "When I Was a Little Girl." Now, Youghal also had its fair share of very brave women who play their part in the Troubles. Lee Cody, formerly Dower, spoke to us about both her mam, who was in Cumann na mBan, and her dad, who was an IRA volunteer before eventually joining the Irish Army.
Dad was a member of the West Waterford Brigade. He came from Ferristown, very active member by all accounts. And Dad was jailed actually in Spike Island and spent many, many months there. So
just to get a timeline on this, this was, I suppose, 1919, 1920. It was before the treaty at any rate.
Yes.
So it was around that time.
It was around that time.
And he took part in the War of Independence.
Yes, he did.
Did he see active service?
Not really.
Right.
No.
And they didn't take part in the 1916. They didn't go. But they were active prior to that.
Active prior to that. And up to the 22.
Right.
They would have been, but Dad was jailed in 1921.
When the treaty came then and they were gradually released, what did he do then?
Well, he could have gone either way. He could have gone privately, but Dad went into the army.
Right.
And he spent 25 years in the Irish Army.
So he would have been a member of the Irish Army during the Civil War then as well?
Yes,
right.
Yeah.
And he was a member of the regular
yes,
the state.
He was.
Right.
Yeah.
So for 25 years you said?
Yes. He was stationed in Collins's Barracks
right.
in Cork.
Yes.
And then he was transferred to Youghal to the old barracks up in Dermotorley.
Right.
And he was there for quite a while. And that's where he met my mum. Here in Youghal.
And who was your mum?
My mum was Bridget O'Brien.
Right.
Her parents came from Old Parish,
right.
County Waterford.
Mm-hmm.
And she was born in Youghal. And she was the only girl, two brothers. And you can imagine they were very protective of her. So when mum was 16, she joined the Cumann na mBan. A secret to her mum and dad. She joined the Gaelic League, and through the Gaelic League they taught Cayley music
right.
and Cayley dancing, and midway during that then they would slip out into another room and have a meeting. Okay. Everything was very secretive. She came home as if she was dancing all night, and that was it.
What age was she when she married?
She was 24.
24, okay. So it was an all Waterford marriage at any rate.
It was an all Waterford marriage.
Yeah. And even though she was born in Youghal.
She was born in Youghal.
But her
roots were in
Old Parish. So we had William Dower and Bridget O'Brien. Could you tell me what activities did Mam get up to when she was a member of Cumann na mBan?
Well, as I say, Mam was very secretive and she never really spoke about it at all. But as she got older, I would be with her at night and we'd sit down and I would ask her and I'd say, just tell me one or two things and so that I could tell the lads when they're grown up. And I think that kind of pushed her a bit. She was probably, the fact that it was a secret from her mum and dad, I think that was part of her, you know, not telling anybody. And when we'd ask her, she'd always say, 'tis in here, 'tis in my heart. I done it for our country. And that was it. She never boasted about it. She never, you know, when people would ask her, she'd be very shy and retiring. And my dad, he was the same. But she did say at one stage that she brought quite a lot of dispatches and they were easy to bring. And she brought a gun on a certain occasion to in Machilly, and she cycled there. left the bike and the gun, but she was being watched like the whole town from the volunteers. They knew she was on the way. And then the plan would be to go back to a safe house, which would possibly be a farm. They were, and many of the Cumnamon women were farmers' daughters, because the farmers' sons were in the IRA. And 90% of the women, believe it or not, were single. When you got married, you were, I won't say demoted, but you were put on desk duty, you know, intelligence work and so much.
But because it was dangerous.
It was dangerous. Right. And now you were married, you had duty.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she would go back to that safe house, and maybe later on the night they would bring her home on horse and cart, or even with another bicycle or a tractor, you know, and bring her back home. And that was how they worked things out. And she was a very active member. And at the time, like, she had a pension from this.
Right.
And my dad had, because they were active members. Yeah, she done it for her country.
The fact that they got pensions would have mean that everything had been, the records had been kept.
Yes.
And so the names appear on the list that, that took part in active duty.
Yes.
Was there any other form of recognition given to them?
Well, they received their medals. They received a medal, both mum and dad have, and I have them here right now. And for their service, they were presented with those.
May we see them? Thank you very much. They appear to be bronze, I'd say.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, yeah, and it's lovely. Have you any idea when they were presented?
I would say in the late 50s.
Okay, because the front is the design of a soldier, and then I think it's the four provinces, the emblems of the four provinces, and down at the bottom of it is Cogan na Saoirse, and that's William Dower, and on the other one, the similar medal, is B. Dower, and in brackets, O'Brien as her maiden name. So you're holding on to them with dear life, yes?
Yes, I am. Even though Mem and Dad were very secretive, I suppose, or quiet or unassuming about their work in the Cumnan and the IRA, we as a family are very proud. Mem has, she was awarded an ONE honorary membership. She was the only woman in Ireland to have that.
What does ONE mean?
Ex-Servicemen.
Okay. The Organisation of National Ex-Servicemen. Yeah. And she was awarded?
An honorary membership.
Okay.
She's the only woman. Mam had a full military funeral with all honours attached, which was very moving and very sad, but very appropriate for who she was.
Right. That's very nice. Margaret O'Connell and Maura Perry also joined us in the studio. Margaret is a relation of Paddy O'Reilly, who's buried in the Republican plot here in Yall, and Maura's mam was in Cumann na Mban.
My mother was very, very young when she was involved. Her name was Kathleen McLaughlin, and they lived in McCurtainstown, the Strand. And she was, when the rising started, my grandfather, God rest him, her father, he was very agitated one day because word came down to Yall that the rising had started. And from then on, they got very involved, you know, little place. But she was the youngest in the common and the smallest. Being like that, she did messages for people, like you see. And she, you know, that's how the women in the common did their business. They'd bring messages and maybe carry a gun. People wouldn't think to stop them, like, because, you know, their demeanour and that. But she did cycle to Dublin one time and she with a message. Now, we don't know who to. It was from Yall, and we don't know who it was because she wouldn't tell us. That went to the grave with her, but we know it's true because we have her medals to prove it, that she, you know, that she was involved. And her recollection of the come in that time was they did things and raised money for the boys, like, you know, they'd have dances and ceilidhs and do messages and that kind of thing. But she told us that it was an awful time in Yall at the time because the streets were patrolled and you couldn't be out after a certain time. And if you're going for a doctor or a priest, may God help you, like, you know. But they were terrible. We had the Hampshire Regiment in town and they were terrible. They were absolutely dreadful. And there was a lot of the young men on the run. One of them was Jimmy Quayne. God rest him. His brother had the fish shop there in Yall, Brendan Quayne. and he was very active, and he was shot over in Piltown. And the word came through that he had been shot. And then, of course, that time they would use the ferry too. You see the boat over in Heather. I suppose that's how the message came through, that he had been shot. And the military brought him in that night on the back of a lorry. And his poor mother went down to the Market Square, and she was in a terrible state, my mother said. And the boys that were on the run, his comrades, they couldn't come in because they were on the run. And when the night he was buried, then they came in and they did volley over his grave. And he's buried in the Republican plot outside now with Paddy Riley, Margaret's cousin, and a few more of them. But, you know, there was a friend of my mother's who was involved as well. She was a girl called Molly Ring. She lived in Carkill. She would be a cousin of Paddy Ring, Sarsfield's Terrace. He was a councillor at the Rings in Sarsfield's Terrace. That time you had to have the names of the people in your house written on the back of your door. The soldiers would come any time, demand to see who had the names. If it was anyone there that shouldn't be there, well, that was it. But Molly had the names written as Gaelge. So they pulled her out by the hair and she got jail. So that's the kind of a thing it was like, you know, you had no, well, you were less than second class citizens, really. Like, you know, just treated you with contempt and that was it. And the women that were in it at the time now, Nora Power, she was Dick Power's mother, Dick the butcher. She was their lady captain. And then you had Mrs. Harlan, he out the Strand. She had a son of priest right opposite the Strand Church. And you had Madge Halloran, Mrs. Dower out in Taylor Street, Mrs. Donovan, the lighthouse shop, Mamie Webb, she married after some men called Hartnett, Mina Hellesy, but they were all great women of their time, and they never sought any recompense for it. They just did what they felt they should do. But all those women, they all took great parts in it. They were all very active and very behind the scenes, right? They did great work in baking and raising money and all that. They were great. One woman there now in particular, Mrs. Hurley, she had a gun. She was working with somebody. He had a gun. And they came to the place. It was up St. Raphael's. And they came looking for him. And he threw the gun at her. And she kept it. Never thought. But, I mean, they did. And if she was caught, she'd have been shot. They just did it like that. You know, they were great people. And then, of course, Margaret's cousin there, Paddy Riley, he was a great man. Very young man, gave his life, devoted his life to it. And he was shot in Waterford. And the thing is, there was a man from Yarl, shaved him the night before he was shot. And they prayed together. And Paddy Riley was full of forgiveness for whoever shot him. It was wonderful. Like, people were very, I suppose, they had great faith, of course. They had great faith. They knew they would go to the Lord when all this was over, because they did it for the cause, for people who were oppressed people. And they did it because they had to do it.
I do not grudge them, Lord, I do not grudge my two strong sons that I have seen go out to break their strength and die, they and a few in bloody protest for a glorious thing. They shall be spoken of among their people. The generation shall remember them and call them blessed. But I will speak their names to my own heart in the long nights, the little names that were familiar once round my dead hearth. Lord, thou art hard on mothers. We suffer in their coming and their going. And though I grudge them not, I weary of the long sorrow. And yet I have my joy. My sons were faithful and they fought.
The last letter of Patrick O'Reilly, executed the 25th of January 1923, to his mother from Ballybricken prison the night before he was executed. My dearest mother, this is my last letter writing to you in this world. Mother, I fought purely and simply as a soldier of the Irish Republican Army, and I am proud of what I have done for poor old Ireland. Some of the Irish people may say hard things about me now, but one day they will realise the sacrifice I have made, and all for them. Mother, don't shed one single tear for me, as someday you will feel proud that you reared your only son to fight and die for the old cause of the Republic. I am in a cell by myself tonight, but feel very happy and never more brave. Mother, I will be in heaven this time tomorrow night
Recombinant, Hurley, Jim Quayne, Tom Power, Willie Hoare, and all my friends who were killed in Clanmult. Remember me as a soldier who died for poor old Ireland. Dearest mother, be as brave as you always were when you hear of this sad news. There will be bright and happy days in Ireland yet, and that before long, I hope. I am sending you on all my Sacred Heart badges and medals, which you can give to my comrades and friends. Say goodbye to Mrs. Quayne and all the family for me. Malik is one of the bravest soldiers I have ever met, and credit to his family. Mother, you would not believe how big and strong I am now. Even the officers here remark it. Tell all my comrades not to have any reprisals for us, as two wrongs never make a right. I forgive everyone that ever said anything about me, hoping they will forgive me for anything I ever said about them. Dear Mother, as I only have a few hours to live, it would take me weeks to write to all my friends. I will write one letter, which you can copy and send to all of them for me. Good night now, and say a prayer for me. Remember me to Maggie, Molly, Annie, Bridget, uncles and aunts, as I have no time to write to them. Darling Mother, this is my last goodbye, and may God and His Blessed Mother bless you all at home with deepest sympathy from your only darling son, Patrick O'Reilly, Vice Commandant, IRA. Paddy O'Reilly was my father's first cousin. His father and my grandmother were brother and sister. His father's name was Michael O'Reilly, and my grandmother's name was Margaret O'Reilly. And Michael and his wife had five children, four girls, and a boy, Paddy. The girls all emigrated. They all went to England, and Paddy stayed in Ireland. Well, I'd say they were still in Ireland when he was shot, but they all emigrated after he died, and they lived out in Green Cloyne, where the old folks' home is, around that area there they lived when he was shot. And they later moved into the cemetery, and the fellow was a caretaker in the cemetery, North Abbey Cemetery, and he died in there, actually, in the house in North Abbey. But Paddy, he was vice commandant in the common in Yall, and very active altogether. He was executed, as Maura said, in Waterford, and he was only 24 years of age, but very, very active in the common altogether. It must have been very hard on the family, like, when, you know, he was their only boy, like. And like Maura said, they probably were persecuted every night, because they had to put the names up. There was a curfew, and after a curfew, nobody could go out. And they could come along, and they just break the door in and go up the stairs, out in the back. You'd hear stories, some stories like that. If they went in to a house, he could be one of the IRA fellas could be living there, and they could just take off out the back door and through the fields or through yards and into different houses. But like, that's the way it was then, like. Then my father's other cousin, I know we're talking about Paddy Riley, but Jack Daly then was another one of them. And Jack was shot down in Nina. He actually nearly died. He had a plate in his head up to the time he died. But they had safe houses all over the country. Paddy Riley, there was a couple of houses around Clashmore and Grange that Paddy Riley used to stay in. Jack, it was down around Tipperary. That's the area he was. And he was in Kilmainham. I actually have his diary from Kilmainham. And there's some lovely, a lot of it is in Gaelic, and some of it in English, written in English, from fellas all over the country, you know, from different parts of the country.
Margaret and Maura also spoke about the time Dev came to town.
I remember when we were very young now, and your mother was probably there. I don't know, but I can remember being up in Carkill, and Dev was in town.
Oh, leave me alone.
And up to Daly Shop.
Yeah.
And we were all on the hill, and this big tall man with the black suit yeah. and the cut hat, they were everywhere. There was people everywhere. And then you probably remember when Jack's parlour, he had pictures of De Valera inside in the parlour.
My mother had
And the proclamation was in the parlour as well. The parlour now was off the shop, it was only a little room, half the size of this. Tiny, but it was Jack's sitting room. And he'd have his radio on there every day, and he'd listen to, you know, the news and what have you, read the paper and that. But he brought De Valera up to the lane, up to Cork Hill. We were also the only ones in the country had De Valera on the hill.
Our friends over in West Waterford also have many stories to tell around the time of 1916. Tommy Mooney has studied this period of our history extensively, and he spoke to us about the volunteer movement and activities over on the other side of the bridge after the Rising.
I'd say they wouldn't have heard of the Rising until after it had happened, maybe several days. They wouldn't have had the information about it. They'd have heard rumours, obviously, because even in Dungarvan, there was a lot of confusion. And Dungarvan had a courier from Dublin sent to them, especially, who came via Waterford City to them, you know. So there was a lot of confusion.
Was there any talk of volunteers, either in Dungarvan or Ardmore, of joining the Rising?
Yeah, there was in Dungarvan. There was a brief flurry when George Lennon, young man, he was only in his 20s. He wouldn't even have been 20 at the time, actually. He was only about 16 or 17. And Pax Whelan, who became the brigadier of the area in later years, they went out and stopped the train that they'd been told was carrying arms to Cork. I think they were to Kilworth or somewhere like that. But it transpired that it wasn't. It was the wrong train. So that was the only activity. And they were watched all the way by RSC men, local RSC men, because it was known who they were. They thought probably not at the time, but it was actually known.
So the intelligence of the British forces was good enough in that particular area.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course the executions then was probably a huge error on the part
I think
of
it
the
was, you know, and I think they admit that themselves, even the British government admitted it themselves that they made a mistake.
And how did that, when the news of that broke, and also Thomas Kent's execution,
yeah,
did it galvanise
yes,
it did,
Liam. Having read a lot of witness, all the witness statements actually from this area and Cork and Dublin, it did, it's mentioned in several of the statements that the executions were a galvanising factor for them, you know.
All that happened, and the effect had galvanised the local volunteers.
Yeah.
And how did the government of the day then react to this?
Yeah, well, there were roundups. There were roundups of volunteers after 1916, and I think it was roughly about 2,000 were sent to Frangach in Wales as prisoners. You know, not as prisoners of war now, but just as prisoners. And I understand that at least very close, we say, to half of them had no volunteer activities whatsoever. But because they were known by the local police and that their names were given in, and if they were foolish enough to hang around, they were picked up and ended up in Frangach also, you know.
So all the time, presumably, the re-galvanised volunteers in the area began arming themselves.
Yes.
And where were they going to get these arms from, or where did they organise their army?
They got the most amazing collection, I believe, of stuff. My father told me himself that they raided the lighthouse in Minehead, and they got a blunderbuss and a sabre and some kind of a shooting rifle, you know. I don't know, it would have been a 22, but a sports gun, you know. But others then, of course, went to some of the big houses, and shotguns were what they wanted, really. Double barrels or heavy shotguns, you know. And they got some of them from mostly with cooperation. I suppose you don't argue with someone with a pistol coming to the door and looking for your shotgun. But a lot of them got them. Farmers now nearly all had a shotgun in those days, and they gave them up pretty willingly by all accounts, you know. But there was an order given to the RIC to go and collect, because they had heard about this going on. And the RIC beat them to a lot of the places and had the guns collected before they could get there, you know.
And did they, when I mean, they were forming themselves into an army, the Irish Volunteer Army, and were there parades and training? And
they used to parade. I know in Old Parish they used to train at night time. My father even showed me the field where they used to drill. They had no guns, of course. They'd make a rifle out of a bit of a forest bush.
In the background to all of this, then, politically, Sinn Féin must have been coming to the fore, and...
It was. Yeah, it was, because Cathal Brua, actually, who became the first Minister for Defence in the Dáil, when the first Dáil was formed in 1919, he used to come around the area. He was a director and salesman for Lawler Candles of Dublin. They were ecclesiastical candle people, and he'd come to the various parishes and sell candles. I think they just sell incense in there as well to the churches, you know. But he would come, and that was his cover. He would go to the local Sinn Féin or somebody of a nationalistic background. And in my own case, my granduncle, John Foley, was one of the Foleys who were collected to Knockmanlay. That family, but a lot of them were Fenians, you know, and had been involved in the Land League and the Planet campaign up here in East Cork. So John was known to be a follower of theirs, and Brua got him to set up a Sinn Féin club in Ardmore. That's how it started there. But Mihála Foulu, who was not related directly to him, but was the man who started the Irish College over there in the later years. The two of them were involved in setting up Sinn Féin.
The first, I suppose you'd say, significant action in the Ardmore area. Mm. What was that?
Well, I suppose the first significant one would have been the first attack on the RIC barracks in the middle of the village. There's the White Horse's restaurant is now.
Oh.
There was an attack made in that overnight. The IRA took it over what's now O'Reilly's Tig Beog bar across the road. That was a lock-up premises owned by Flemings and Yall here in those days. And they opened fire on it. But there was an accidental shot was fired, which gave warning to the RAC in the barracks that they were going to be attacked. So there was a futile volley of
when
shots.
When you say accident, is it in inverted commas?
No,
it was
we
an
don't
accident.
Know. All we know is that there was a shot fired before the order was given, and it tipped off
the RIC.
Yeah.
So this was really apart from the tens, of course, were they?
No, they weren't there at that stage.
But did they come eventually to Ardmore?
They did, but they only came to Ardmore on a couple of raids, I think about twice ever.
So where were they stationed?
They were stationed in either Yall or Dungarvan. They had a lot of them in Yall, and they had another section of them
so
in Dungarvan.
So they wouldn't be notorious because of their actions in the Ardmore area?
They were because they came and they took a lot of fellas prisoner, a lot of other fellas prisoner. And in the case of my own granduncle that I mentioned, they kicked in his door, knowing that he was, or having been told that he was the Sinn Féin man.
Right.
They gave him a beating and took him off as a hostage in their lorry, and, you know, against being ambushed. They had him as a shield, you know.
I see.
And he was a middle-aged man, you know, corpulent and all the rest of it. He was no threat to them militarily. He was just used as a...
And
you know,
did he was eventually released?
Oh, eventually he was released,
but he didn't see time in any of the camps?
No.
They
said nothing against him other than that he was a politician, if you like.
Right, okay.
You know, but that didn't stop them, you know.
So we had the tens. Was there regular British Army still around?
There was a small squadron of British Royal Marines were installed in the old Coast Guard station up in Ardmore Head.
Right.
But I don't think they were. They had one or two skirmishes with the locals over around Piltown and that. But generally speaking, they were kept under control by snipers, you know.
Right.
Fellas used to go up and snipe at them to keep their heads down, all of them, you know.
Right.
And there was only about 20 of them there.
Okay,
you know?
But there was nothing major that they had to get help from either Dungarvan or Yall.
Well, that was they noticed that when they were attacking Ardmore barracks.
Yes.
That the Marines tried to come down from the Coast Guard, but they had a row of fellas picked out here and there to keep them back, and they noticed that they fired Veery lights. into the air from the barracks to draw attention to from the fellas in Yall here, the RSC in Yall and the Blackentowns in the barracks up above, you know. So they noted that, and the next time they attacked the barracks, the same thing happened. So they used that as a kind of a ploy for Piltown ambush. They set up a mock attack on the barracks and to draw out the Tans out from Yall. You know? But luckily for them, when the people did come from Yall, when the soldiers did come from Yall, there was no Tans. They all happened to be in Cork at some kind of a briefing that day. So it was only ordinary soldiers, regular soldiers, who came out with a young officer who was only a teenager, I believe, 19 years of age or something like that.
That led on to the ambush.
Piltown ambush, yeah.
And were there any casualties?
Yeah, there was one soldier shot dead. The driver of the lorry was shot dead in the ambush. And there was another fellow badly wounded. And the British were very slow to give out their records of the losses in action, you know. So we don't know if there was a second one. Some people say there was a second. Some witness statements claim there was a second man shot. The IRA had no casualties whatsoever, you know. They had, even though all they had was shotguns, and I think they had a Winchester rifle. It was the most deadly weapon they had with them, you know. That was Sean Reardon's. But after that ambush, they had enough service rifles to furnish the column men, which was just newly formed at the time. They gave each of them a 303.
So you mentioned to the local flying column at the time, but what were the principal IRA units in the area at the time?
West Waterford was divided into four battalions, and the third battalion was the Ardmore All Parish area, which was mainly involved with Piltown. But they had been forming a column with the best men from the four battalions. So they were there at Piltown as the elite force, we'll call them, if we can call them that, you know. Almost, you know, virtually unarmed, you could say, but they had a couple of shotguns and you know, this one Winchester. But after that, they were a formidable force because they had 303 rifles, and they carried out quite a few ambushes and attacks after that, you know. Led by a young man called George Lennon, who was only the same age as the century, so 1920 he was 20 years of age, you know, and he was one of the youngest, if not the youngest, column commanders in the country at the time.
You know. And you're mentioning that the flying columns there were in Ardmore, and there was one in Dungarvan, I presume.
No, that was just the whole West Waterford. They weren't based in Ardmore. They would have been based, I suppose, sometimes in the Cumara Mountains, sometimes around Colligan, Ballymacarbery.
This is the flying column now?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But when you
they
mentioned,
were on the move, it's sort of called flying column.
They were the best taken from the four companies.
Another factor that brought them into the column was if they were on the run. If they had been marked down as going to be picked up by the police, they would bring them into the column and arm them and keep them away from their houses and that, you know.
Right, and obviously there were safe houses at that time.
There were indeed, yeah, lot of the farmers. In fairness to some of the farmers from, not always the biggest ones.
Right.
They would keep them overnight, maybe two or three nights sometimes, you know.
Right, and
feed them as well.
You have a poem there. You told me earlier about it. Where did you get it from?
I got it from my father, actually, years and years ago. It was in he was in Ballykindler camp in prison for a year nearly, and he had, as they all had, they had these autograph albums that they used to hand around, you know, to different fellas writing into it, you know, all kinds of things. I'll just read it to you because I thought it was nice, you know. It says, well, maybe nice is the wrong word to use. It's kind of stirring.
Appropriate as well.
Yeah, appropriate. Remember still, through good and ill, how vain were prayers and tears, how vain were words till flashed the swords of the Irish volunteers. By arms we've got the rights we sought through long and wretched years. Hurrah, 'tis done, our freedom's won. Hurrah for the volunteers.
Tommy Mooney, Gurumila Mahagud.
No, Haberin.
The 1916 commemorations in Tallaght were centred around the grave of Arthur Mulcahy, who was shot by the Crown Forces in 1921. Arthur's nephew, Art Supple, spoke to us at the gravesite of his uncle at Tallaght Cemetery.
My name is Arthur Supple, better known, I suppose, as Art Supple, and we're standing here by the gravesite of my uncle, Arthur Mulcahy, who, as it reads here on his headstone, shot by Crown forces on the 22nd of March 1921. Arthur was a brother of my mother. Her name was Mary Mulcahy, and in that particular family they lived in Corrobay. The father's name was William and the mother's name was Hannah, and they lived in Corrobay, and they had my mother, who was Mary, they had Dennis Mulcahy, and they had Michael Mulcahy, and they had Alice Mulcahy. These were all people, and of course Arthur, were all part of the one family. And on the 22nd of March in 1921, the forces of the Crown called to the house where they lived in Corrobay, and it was quite customary at the time that they would have raids from the armed forces, and people were quite used to that. And this was always regarded by the Irish people at the time, frightening and all as it was strictly speaking a form of terrorism. And when they called to the homes of people like that, they would call at any hour of the day or night, they would train their rifles on the house and rough the people up, generally, and verbally especially, and it was always very, very difficult for people to deal with it. But in my mother's house alone, there had been 42 of these particular raids down through the troubled times. And on this occasion, when they called to the house, Dennis and Arthur were in the house with my mother and Alice, and the father and mother as well. And when they called in, they had looked at the list of names that were on the back of the door, and they said, we want to interview this particular individual, who was Arthur. So at that time, you had to have a list of the people that were in the house on the night, and they would look through the list to make sure that everybody was accounted for. It was almost like a roll call. So Arthur came out of the bedroom, and he was bleary-eyed in the middle of the night, naturally enough, and they took him out, and his father said to him, lace up your boots. And one of the people in charge said, it won't be worth his while to lace up his boots. So, I mean, that in itself was a bad omen. But they went down the road a little bit from there, and there's now a cross erected at that particular point where they stood, Arthur Mulcahy, up against the fence. The soldiers went to the other side of the road, behind the fence, in case that the ricochet of the bullets would affect them. So they literally stood the width of the road away from him, and they opened fire with the Enfield 303 rifles, and they shot him. And then they bayoneted him as well, because he was a physically very, very fine specimen of a man. He was an athlete. He was in the prime of his life, a fair-haired, blue-eyed guy, and big, strong man, and he was in great condition, and physically, apparently, he didn't die, you know, and we don't know at what point he did die, where there have been conflicting views, some of which have even gone on to the following morning, that he may have still been alive in the back of the military lorry until the following morning, when that military lorry returned to Fomoy. And then the parents, of course, wanted to find out what had happened, and they went to the barracks, and they found out that he had been shot. So my mother and her father, William, were allowed in to the barracks to be able to see his mutilated corpse. And from that point, they made the arrangements to take him back home. And eventually, when his body was released to the Mulcahy family, he was brought here to Tallow Cemetery to be buried. And as they came over the bridge here in Tallow, again, the Crown forces interrupted the funeral cortege, and they dragged the tricolour, which had been on the coffin, they dragged the tricolour off the coffin, or tried to drag it off. And anyhow, that they're all part of the little details of it. And I suppose it reflects the time and the feelings of the people and the terror of the people that they existed in during that time, because you never knew from one day to the next when, you know, that military lorry would pull up outside your door and one of your family could be taken away, arrested, thrown in jail without trial, or, as in the case of Arthur Mulcahy, brought down to a remote side of the road and shot, you know. So these people went through a very, very tough time, and that was the way it was. So he's interred here in this particular cemetery now, and he's in the family plot. Three.
about to lay down. He went to his death like a true son of Ireland, and the firing party he bravely did face when the order rang out, present arms.
In the years leading up to 1916, all political activity here was overshadowed by the Great War. And y'all men in their droves had signed up for action abroad, and those who survived came home to a very different Ireland.
We know it's about 1,000 enlisted, there's a lovely book printed by the Cork Examiner on those who died in World War I from the Cork area. Alphabetically lists all the different sections. Like there's one particular man now in Yall I was very interested in. His father was the rector in St. Mary's, a fellow called Eric Hodges, and he fought in World War I. He died in 1916. So he changed to the Royal Irish Rifles. They had no problem sending a child over to the war, and he's on the Battle of the Somme, and he's one of the casualties. Economically, things were dreadful, and bodies were bodies. If you think of England in the 19th century, they were involved in 190 different wars in the 19th century. I mean, all over the world, literally, they needed bodies, 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 bodies. Mm-hmm. And in some of the cases, in some of the colonies, you had an annual mortality rate of over 50%. It was just horrendous. Yeah. You can get what's called the war diary. They give you day by day what actually happened. The British artillery were getting their ranges wrong, so they were firing on their own troops. They were then sent out the cavalry against the German machine guns. And the cavalry had no hope in hell. The soldiers themselves hadn't got enough ammunition. So you have guys sending notes back, we're pinned down, we have no ammunition. I mean, it's horrific. The mistakes that were made. It was a dreadful waste of life. In 1916, they began this with the executions, which were totally unnecessary, and especially the execution of James Connolly, who probably was a dying man when he was executed. It was a dreadful thing. And later on, then a couple of months later, when Casement, his name is blackened, and then he's hanged. And why he was hanged rather than shot like the others is a huge issue there. But the people began to turn completely and utterly against the army, against the British government, and they began to see what was...
Did this cause any friction then in your... Remember now that we've had, as you told us, the over 1,000 had enlisted in the British army. They would have been coming home, those of them who survived. And then what would be the feeling here? Was there any outrage?
If you wanted to get a really lovely picture of what it was like, William Trevor, who wrote that Ballroom of Romance, and he has a beautiful book called The Story of Lucy Gault. And in it, he talks about an army officer who has a house just outside Yall on the River Blackwater. And he comes back from World War I, and he cannot believe the world has changed. His peasants, his people on his estate, they have changed. And they suddenly no longer want to be seen with him. They don't want to talk to him. The world, the atmosphere has changed. And you'll see it over and over again. The young man Hodges that I mentioned earlier on, whose father was the rector, there were two brothers fought in the war. The brother who came home was so appalled by the atmosphere when he came home, he emigrated straight away, went to South Africa, never came back to Ireland. The family has never come back. But the atmosphere had changed completely. That those who supported the war were in one category and everybody else was in the other. And there was a huge, overwhelmingly negative attitude towards the war afterwards.
Local actress and writer Ruth Hayes used the diary of her granduncle Jeremiah O'Shaughnessy, which is a treasured family possession, as the inspiration behind her radio drama, The Diary, which aired on CRY 104 FM recently.
Then evening came, and I proceeded with my company to relieve the Cameron Highlanders in the firing line at St. Eloi.
Attack! tell me any room to move. I can barely get through this mud.
Grab hold of my hand. Lad! Help me pull that through. One, two, three, pull!
Stay down!
Do I see?
I'm all right, Doc.
My cock lens down.
Jesus, there's bodies everywhere.
Just keep moving, Finn, and don't look down.
We need more supplies. Retreat to headquarters.
As we retreated 1.5 miles through the bullet and shell-infested area, we were in terror of our lives.
Finbar, keep your head down.
Fire shrapnel burst right over our heads.
Jerry, I can't hear anything.
Just keep moving forward and stay low.
Come on, you lot. Let's go.
I can't see where I'm going. Jerry, where are you?
I'm right behind you. Just keep moving.
When we get back, we...
Finbar!
Stay down, soldier.
We can't leave him there.
We must get back to headquarters. We can return in the morning.
As we made our way back, I was so exhausted that I lay on the muddy road and was taken to a cellar in the ruined village where our headquarters were. I remained there for 24 hours, unable to get the smell of blood out of my head.
Back about 20, 30 years ago, this diary came into our family. It was belonging to my grandfather, Timothy O'Shaughnessy, and the diary actually belonged to his brother, Jeremiah O'Shaughnessy, who fought in the Great War. And he had kept this diary, and it was sent back to my granddad way back when, but it was never spoken about in the interim. And he passed it on to my father, Noel O'Shaughnessy, and it stayed in our family for a while and nobody really kind of looked at it until a few years later. And we all, it kind of piqued our interest really because it was such a human story. And the story was, it followed Jeremiah's life from 1914 up to 1915. He had fought with the British Army and he was stationed in Faizabad in India. And he had gotten the call to come to England and to train before going ahead to the front lines. And that's kind of really where this story began. And it was such a human story, and it followed his fears, his hopes, his dreams, his family situation. He was only 25. So many men had fought in the British Army for so many different reasons. It could have been home rule, it could have been for the widow's pension, it could have even been for a sense of adventure. And that was something really that kind of, it really spoke to me. And that's why I wanted to write this story then, this 10-part drama called The Diary that was here on CRY. And I wanted to explore what must have been in his mind? What must he have gone through? I wanted to kind of flesh it out because, like that, it had been a diary in our family for so long. And it was something that I had even used as a specialist subject topic for my leaving cert. So it's always there and it was always in the back of my mind. And I just wanted to flesh him out and to give him life again, really, because he had died actually in 1915 out in Flanders Field in Belgium. So that's what I did. That's what I went about doing. One of the main things we wanted to get across as well was the horror that the men faced when they went to the front line. And Jeremiah writes very eloquently and poignantly about his last days in Belgium as he'd come from France. They'd marched from France in the very, very cold and wet, treacherous conditions of France and Belgium. And he spoke about, he'd written about his last few nights in Belgium and the dark and the very cold houses that they had stayed in, and then going into the front line and the absolutely horrific conditions that were there, even the sounds that were all around them. He speaks about the noises of the guns being incessant and not leaving his head, and what that must have been like for him, just for any man really listening to that. It just, they thought they were there for adventure, but it turned out to be an absolute nightmare. And then he speaks and he writes about his last night in Belgium and how he's about to go to the front line again and how men have come back from the front line and he can't believe the difference in them from their last time being in the house with him. And he speaks about how they're shaken to the core and they barely want to even speak about it, and they're soaking wet and their legs are stiff because they've been in one position for 48 hours at a time. So we really wanted to get that across, and we wanted to get across the sounds as well of the battlefield, and we wanted to make sure as well it wasn't gratuitous, because it's something we wanted to honour these men with and make it as poignant as possible and stay true to his words as possible.
Oh, how do you do, young Willie McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside and rest for a while in the warm summer sun? I've been walking.
Our thoughts and prayers are with all those who lost their lives during this extremely difficult time in our nation's history, no matter what side of the divide they fell on. And that brings an end to our programme, Our 1916. And we hope that we have captured some of the memories and stories from our locality during the time of the Troubles. And we hope that this programme will help in some way to preserve some of those memories and this part of our history for another 100 years.
Our 1916 was made with the support of Cork County Council, presented by Liam O'Leca, edited by Thomas O'Keefe, produced by Dara Parker, with special thanks to all those who made this programme possible: Jim Ryan, Kieran Greger, Tommy Mooney, Maura Perry, Margaret O'Connell, Lee Cody, Art Supple, Siobhan Fogarty, Willie McCarthy and Ruth Hayes. A Community Radio Y'all production. Forever 19, or are you a stranger without even...